When you left, what did you do? Just abandon the company's property there?
Well, it's, I believe after I left, there was still right many of the Americans left out
there. Oh, is that right?
And they maintained the business right on until probably when the communists come in, they might not have even bothered the factors for another month or two. Mm-hmm. Or they might not have bothered the people. But some that were suspicious, they put them under house arrest. They had to stay in the house all the time. They couldn't get out and go nowhere. Mm-hmm. And there's always the local authority who'll give the dominating group the information they want, you know, when they come in.
So the company did leave people out there?
Yeah, and most of them got out without trouble. Those who were under house arrest got out without trouble. The communists didn't bother them. They didn't want to bother them. They just wanted to come in and take over the country and the government and everything and confiscate everything at a foreign origin or anything.
Any particular stories you recall from that period? Particular incidents?
Well, that would have happened after I left.
Well, I mean, before the period before you left is what I meant.
And during the communist takeover?
During that period between 46 and 49.
No, actually, I can't recall anything that was abnormal, I'd say, to any extent, because this was a fact in the people's mind. They knew that the communists would go come and take the place because Mao had his men out too. Mm-hmm. Thousands of them, probably hundreds of thousands of them. Well, in Shanghai, a city of, maybe 6 or 8 million, at least. 8, I think. I know at 12 o'clock in the daytime, you could look at Nanking Road and Suchow Road where they crossed. You could see 250,000 people if you get high enough to see them at that hour. Any angle you looked. 250,000 people. I know one day, 1937, right after we disembarked, maybe it was that day or the next day, Japanese eased in and dropped a bomb right between the Palace Hotel and the Broadway Mansions, or the Sassoon House, rather. And when it hit right in the middle of the sewer line. The main sewer line in the city was right down under Nanking Road, going right into the Wongpu River. And that bomb tore up. Place up, it killed, let's see, it was 370 some people killed from that one little bomb, and the blood trickled just like if you take a bucket of water and pour it down the gutter. It couldn't have been over a 50 pound bomb. They estimated it at a 50 pound bomb. But the fragment, and as many people as there at the time when it dropped, about 4:30. The people were just like the hair on the head all the time on Nanking Road. You couldn't walk down there without squeezing through them. And when that bomb hit, it killed that many people. I've got a lot of literature stored back. I don't know where it is. It might be in Wilmington in my sister's house. And I had had pictures. I must have had 2,000 pictures. Over that period of time during the war and all that. And when I got out of the service, I come back home, my mother's house had burned down while I was away. Caught fire and burned down. And there was a trunk. I had a big old black trunk in there and I had those pictures in that trunk. And that was saved. I saved part of the pictures. But before I got out of service and got back home, a lot of the kids got in them and they tore the book up and they destroyed a lot of my pictures. A lot of little things that I had, you know, that I wanted to keep. But it just vanished. And if they saw a picture, they'd like it turned out of the way and keep it. And for that reason, I've never gotten it back together and I still got a lot of stuff, but it takes time and I just don't have the time to do it.
China. You never wrote home to your family while you were out there.
But, in China?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What happened to those letters? Did they not keep them?
It's doubtful. I think everything that my father had, my father died in July 1941, just before I got home. And I would believe that all of those were burned in the house. I got every one my wife wrote me. I kept every one of them while I was in the service and in China.
But none of the ones you wrote from
in the
Orient got
that? I don't know what she did with the ones I wrote her. Yeah, I would, there would be a lot of valuable excerpts of things mentioned. But
very important.
Just in sitting and talking like I've talked to you, it's hard to put everything in sequence.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
But at one time, I had 380 pages of a diary of my first 4 years out there.
What happened to it?
Well, that's why I lost it in the fire.
God.
You see, what I had planned to do, I was going to write a book. I couldn't write it because I can't write. I'm not a writer. But I've got a good memory. I can remember dates as far back as 50 years ago. As good as it is if it happened today. I can remember August the 18th, 1937, just like today. I might not remember this date you and I talking. I could say we did it in April, but I wouldn't know the date. In other words, like that cartoon I saw in the paper where the man in the hammock and Carter says, you first got to get their message to them, you know, and clip a roof. First they got to get the message. But first, you have to be impressed,
yeah,
or you can't remember a date. I can remember how many inches in a foot or how many feet in a mile, but it's kind of hard to remember all the things.
Mm-hmm. And all those things. Put them in the proper.
Yeah, things, you have to talk like we're talking. You talk as things come to your mind, not in sequence, but as it comes to your mind. But if I had a mule, you see that, the feudal system, or the feudal age, as you might call it, lasted through about, I'd say about 1900. That was to any great extent. Then it kind of waned off under Dr. Sun Yat-sen. He seemed to change the lifestyle of the people and their thoughts. Instead of them being a dream of 1,000 flowers, they were dreaming of probably 5,000 flowers. Well, Mao always talked of 1,000 flowers. But the attitude of the people changed to the extent that there was less robbery, there was less vandalism as a whole, you might say, and there was fewer people trying to make trouble. And it kind of waned off, and maybe once in a while you'd hear of a certain province having trouble with another, but it wasn't like it was, say, in 1700 and 1800.
Well, I'm saying that during the 1920s and early 30s, the warlords were still fighting.
Yeah, that's right.
With each other.
Yeah. Now, some of the older guys that you've talked to, they could tell you about it. Because we had one man that was kidnapped up in Ur-Shlupu, up at one of the buying stations, and his name was St. Newsom. They kidnapped him and packed his ears with wax and put him in a well for 8 days while they were manipulating, trying to get the,
ransom?
Yeah.
Why did they pack his ears with wax?
So he couldn't hear what they were talking about. They didn't want him to remember anything about names or the group or where they were from or anything like that, because he'd been out there for years and he knew most of the people up in that area up there. He knew the farmer's person. He'd go out and shake hands with him and talk to him too. Like old Chinaman come to me one time and he said, now I'd only been up there two times. He said, Mr. Gore, I want to give you a little gift. Well, he thought I'd probably raise his back by a pound, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe one of the buyer's money, but we never did do that kind of thing. But he gave me it was nothing much, but in the way he gave it to me, it was worth $1 million. It's a sitting woman, sitting half doll. And there was a hole in it, and he'd been wearing it around his neck, he told me. 18 years. Mr. Newsom gave him that. He says, I want to give it back to you so you can remember me, and I can remember him. You see? That's that circle of thought, and it'll wind up that way with him if he's dead. I'm sure he's dead now because he's about 65 then.
Yeah.
Or he might not be dead. They live to be real old. But he said he gave it to me, and now he's dead. I want to give it to you so you can have it. And I still got it. It's in 1853, I think it's made. But it's no good, because it's got a hole in it. It's just a token. But he was so... meek about the whole thing, you know. He wanted me to have that 50 cent piece.
You never did come in contact with the court system over there, did you?
The what?
The courts, the Chinese courts.
Courts? No, I never did. As a matter of fact, like I said, there's some things about the Chinese that I didn't understand. And one thing was after the funeral, or in and during the immediate funeral service, and the people after that, the reaction and all, you couldn't tell that nobody had died. You wouldn't know that they ever lost a member of the family. The only thing they talk about was birth, rebirth. Sons, particularly.
When I asked the question about death being cheap back some a while ago, the point I was getting at is, I've been told that they Chinese thought nothing of killing other Chinese. That I know one army naval officer was telling me one time that they had a lot of trouble with bodies floating down the river, and so they offered something like a nickel a body for bounty for people who would pull these bodies out of the river and report them. And so they developed into a problem. The Chinese were killing people and turning their bodies in, throwing them in the river, and then so they could collect the nickel.
Well, that sounds incredible to me. I did learn one thing about the Chinese, that there's two things in the world I've heard that will fight to the death, and that's two moose stags or two Chinese people. Now, I've seen them fight with their mouth, cuss each other, and the other wouldn't say a word. Never hit him, never slap him, never say a word until he finished cussing. Then he'd cuss him for 5 minutes, and the other one would listen to him. And I've seen it 1,000 times on the streets where they'd even argue about, one day I was sitting there and the boy was cleaning the carpet or something in the room, and I was watching out the window, and they're hauling their hogs to market. And when they kill them, they get them ready for the market, and then they lace them back up.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll take a quill and slit the skin and blow under the skin, between the skin and the meat, through the fat section. And they'll blow until they get that hog, he'll look like he'll weigh 500 pounds. You just bounce like a ball almost. And they do that in order to balance them on the wheelbarrows or ever what they haul them on, mm-hmm. so they won't roll off or flop, you know.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You've seen pork when it was killed where it uh-huh. was just flabby, you know, uh-huh. when it, before it was frozen.
Uh-huh.
And they blow them up like that. And they skin a lot of them and use the skin for pontoons, for boats, various other things. Sew them up.
Mm-hmm.
I have never in my life heard of Chinese killing each other in everyday life fashion from fights or anything. I've never heard of it as long as I have never heard of it, and I've never heard a Chinaman say that it happened. Now, in 1938, the Japanese had a thing going with the communist government. There were some leaders in Shanghai they wanted to get rid of, and they called it St. Valentine's Massacre. Well, we had that in this country one mm-hmm. time, you know, when they mm-hmm. lined all the guys up and killed them. But the rickshaw coolies is the ones that killed the dignitaries. And a lot of these big, rich Chinese used pedicabs. That was a service. They owned them, and they mm-hmm. had the coolie to pull them. But if they wanted to kill that man, they would get a man to pinch hit for the pedicab puller. And he'd pull the gun right out and blow the man's head off sitting right in the rickshaw. And they had 9 in 1 week. It was killed in Shanghai that way. But that was underworld doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But in civilian life, I dare say, in any province, that one Chinaman will murder another one in a year. In the whole province. There's 21 provinces in that country.
Hmm.
I just never heard of that. Now, I did hear and have seen during the Jap-Chinese War, and going over these war-torn areas and going with the Japs, Jap officers, they'd let you go with them. You get a pass and go with them all day long. They'd go out and check the front, check what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen hundreds of Chinese in the canals, laying in the canals, dead. But that was within a period of, say, 10, 15, or 30 days before the Chinese could come back and claim them and bury them.
That was a result of a battle.
Yeah, that was. They were killed by the Japanese. Mm-hmm. They were killed.
Well, now, in those 2 times that you had to leave, first in 41 and then in 49, you didn't feel any concern for your own safety?
Well, in 1949, I was a little shaky because my wife was with me. If I'd been by myself, I wouldn't have paid any attention to it. Because I don't believe that there's a race on the face of the earth unless it's a pygmy or the crude Indian in South America that will kill you right off the bat for nothing. There's no nationals go kill you if you don't harm them. No more than an animal will if you go out in the woods and run up on a bear out there. He'll run from you unless you shoot him or cripple him. I was never afraid of that. Just like in the war, I wasn't scared of nothing. I didn't do anything I had to do, I'd do it. It didn't bother me at all. But the fact is, become involved with these people. They suspicion you, or you are guilty of something that's detrimental to the country or the people, then they'd have a legitimate right to give you some trouble. But I was never afraid at all, and I wouldn't have been afraid there if the communists had come in. It wouldn't have bothered me a bit in the world. If they said, well, you're under house arrest, I'd have gone under house arrest and stayed there. But there was a lot of people out there, I imagine, that were shaking in their boots, that had done things that left over from Chinese Chiang Kai-shek's army, Navy.
Mm-hmm.
Now those are the ones that work over for real.
Mm-hmm.
I was at a party one night at the Metropole Hotel, and a Chinese officer, I don't know what his rank was, I imagine he's a pretty high ranking officer, but he was talking to a friend of mine, George Monk. Now you've heard of the monks up there in Farmville.
Right.
Well, George is my buddy out there. He's head of the AC Lumpback Company, and we lived next door to him for years. Of course, George passed away, and after they come back and moved to Florida. But this officer told George something. I didn't hear what remark was, but George told him, he said, if you aren't real careful, they'll cut your tongue out. And that's the way to work on them. Keep them talking. Keep them stealing, they cut the hand off. And when I was out there, 1st and 37, I was told by a Chinaman that only one bank had ever been broken. China had gone too far. And they just went right down, pulled their heads right out of the windows and cut them all off to get the right one. And they never did have enough. Now, I don't know where that story's true or not, but I would have a reason to believe that it might be true. Mm-hmm. They just didn't have
Chinese justice.
Yeah. Well, you see a few along, one finger, two fingers, hand cut off. There's a reason for it. You can't delve into it, find out what it is, but there's a reason for it. I saw the Japanese cut off three Chinese heads one morning for stealing telephone wire. They said they stole 2 miles of telephone wire that night. Well, the way their receptacles were put up, they all had to do is cut it at one end, tie a truck to it, and cut it at the other end and drag it off, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe they did steal 2 miles of wire. But there was no reason for them to cut the head off. They had the hands tied, they had the basket in front of them. The guy with the Samuel would come along, off he went. It's pitiful.
It was done as much probably as an example for everyone else. It was done in public, was it not? That's a public display.
Well, it's like a judge down in Alabama yesterday. Those two guys say they weren't going to reform under no circumstances. They do the same thing again. They go out and kill somebody. They said, we'd rather be electrocuted than to stay in prison the rest of our life. And the judge said, well, in that case, I'll just give you your wishes. So he said that they'll be killed in July. Electrocuted. You read that in the paper, didn't you? It's a pity that the whole world can't look at things for a change. Just look at it one way for a change, mm-hmm. The right way. Say, well, all of these 5 billion or 450 billions of people, I reckon it's that now, isn't it? 450 billion
or something. Right.
Why can't everybody just decide for a change for a period of time, just not do nothing bad? Wouldn't it be a wonderful world? Now, when I was a teenager and even up in my manly years, I always picked up the paper and I could read about what was happening. It was very destructive and killing and all this up in the big cities and what have you, but now it's right here under my feet, mm-hmm. right next door. Mm-hmm. Growing in this, I think worldwide, this kind of a trend to kind of tear things up or something.
Decay.
Yeah, Nixon, a lot of people ridiculed him for a lot of things he did, and I think he did some things that was wrong. But I think he did some things that were very constructive, too. He started this fuel shortage thing off, and nobody would listen. He'd give us 55 miles an hour speed law, which is a wonderful trick he turned. He went out and started negotiating relations with China, which I think is one of our future pawns or friends, maybe in this world, if we have a third world war. That's the greatest weapon they'll have, will be China. Because they'll pounce on the Russians if we ever start on the Russians, just as sure as you want. And that's why Russia's building such a big army and navy. And from the day that Gromyko went to California. His first day the United Nations met, he started saying "nyet." And he never said nothing but "nyet." That's all he's ever said since. And that's all Brezhnev or Khrushchev or any of them will ever say is "nyet." They won't agree to nothing you say. The way the communists operate is they ask for, demand 10 times what they want. They get a third, a half, 25%, or maybe what they want. They always get more than they want. They ask it for 10 times as much. Their demand is 10 times greater. We start on a level of reason, and we always give less. Back up, back up. But every time we back up from Russia on this armament thing, they build that many more vessels, ships. They got as many today as America and Britain both put together, too. France included.
But, you know, in the...
Well, it was like they say about the Chinese. It's just a old Chinese joke that the servant does everything he can for his master. And one was being questioned by a friend, and he said, "Well, how is your master so good? Why is he such a good master?" He says, "Well, he gives me a lot of things. He pays me well. He gives me vacations and all that." He says, "Well, but," said, "sometimes he gets real nasty. Sometimes he's a little mean to me." He said, "Well, what do you do for him?" He said, "Well, I just pee in his coffee every morning." But I went to this friend's house to kind of a foreign group got together. It's called foreign parties, you know. And there was a beautiful clock sitting on the mantel. And I thought I recognized it. Well, it was a very delicate glass. It was very light, very thin. And I paid $50-some for it. It was something like 350 or 60 years old. And I asked my wife if she had missed the clock. And she said no. I said, "That's exactly like ours." I said, "Well, you get back home, you look at it." So we got back home. She checked it out to see if it was ours. And ours was gone. So about 3 or 4 days later, we went to the thieves market to buy some things, pick up little trophies and what have you. And our clock was there. And we bought it back for $20.
They'd stolen it back out of his house.
They'd take it from each other and sell it. It was a known thing that they did. It was a racket with them. And they might steal it and sell it 3 or 4 times a year. And you missed
it. Were these your servants who had stolen it?
No. Oh, yeah, yeah. Ours is stolen, too. Yeah. They don't call it stealing. It's just a way of passing things around for a little extra money, you know. In the home, you never did buy food. You didn't buy anything. The boy would buy it, and you would pay him. And he always got enough for he and his wife and his servant, and added it onto your bill. And you knew that was happening, and it was perfectly all right. It was just routine, and you went ahead and paid every what he told you owed. He didn't tell you if he got enough for his family and all, but that was supposed to be that way. Mm-hmm. And it was not much. With all that added, it wasn't much.
Well, I'm sure they resented them. Even though you represented their livelihood, they resented foreign devils coming into their country and lording it over them.
No, I don't think they had that attitude at all. They were very very happy to have the job, and they'd stand by you in face of everything. They'd stick right with you. I know our houseboy come to the airport the day we left, and he cried like a baby. He wanted to come with us. But he told me one time that he was in Wilmington, come on a Chinese freighter, pick up cargo. He was a seaman before he got older. That time he was about 50 years old. But you couldn't light a cigarette. Couldn't do nothing. They wouldn't let you do nothing. You strike your matches. Clean the house and stem to stern every day. There's never anything around that wasn't in place. And when you come in that night, you didn't stay home any afternoon. You were somewhere. You visited somebody, you went to a club, or you went to a party, you went somewhere at night. And he'd know exactly what suit you would go wear, and he'd have it laying out for you. And if it was dress, he'd have dress out. He'd know exactly what your routine was before you ever knew it.
In fact, he probably influenced your routine. Well,
the boys are passing you on another. Mr. Nisgo are coming over to Mr. Monk's house tonight, too. And he'd know exactly what you'd go wear, you know. But they were very capable and efficient, polite in their service and in your company and around. Of course, you never saw them unless you wanted something. Mm-hmm. Or they were serving a meal or something. Mm-hmm. They had quarters attached to the apartment. Slept right there.
What was your first impression when you arrived Shanghai there in August of 1937 and saw your first view of China proper?
Well, it reminded me, or it was almost exactly like I thought it would be. From the books that I had read and the pictures that I had seen of the waterfront and the Bund and the congestion and the way of life, it was a facsimile of what I had read. It was identical almost.
You weren't awed by it?
Pardon?
People. You weren't awed by it?
I was awed to the extent of the crowds and the way so many people could walk and get to their jobs without riding. And the only automobiles, of course, was the taxi companies and company cars. There's quite a few of the influential Chinese had cars, but the masses of the people didn't. Mm-hmm. Had bicycles. And in Peking, I would say at one time I saw maybe 2,000-3,000 people riding on bicycles, just a wave moving along and just like that, one wave right behind. And there was never no malice or trying to rush somewhere because you're acclimated to the movement, which is related to the congestion, and you have to go slow. But many a time we catch a cab maybe from Palace Hotel and want to go to the country club, say, 2 or 3 miles out, and it'd probably take you an hour to get there, 2 or 3 miles. Of course, the cab drivers would swear at them, you know, and they'd go through them and look like they'd go kill them all, but they never did hit them. It's fantastic. It's a shame that people in the world can't live together and have trade and the opportunity to visit lands that are cut off. And I always thought that the reason for it, now particularly in China today and Russia, those two countries particularly, they don't want the type of people going there that would change their lifestyle or encourage, particularly the youth, to change their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. The Chinese, they don't want that because that's where they, that's one of the main things today that's keeping those countries as tightly sealed as they are. However, you can go to Russia. But you're watched every second while you're there.
Well, you know several people who have visited Russia.
Yeah. I would believe that the university could form a group, go out.